Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Lundman representing the federal defendants appellants. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. When the West Virginia northern flying squirrel was listed as endangered in 1985, the Fish and Wildlife Service believed that the squirrel was very rare and its habitat was severely fragmented. Over the next 20 years, the research into the squirrel established the squirrels in much better shape. The service found many more squirrels, found them in many more places, and the health of the squirrel's habitat improved as well over that period. Following this research, the service applied the five factors set forth in Section 4A1 of the Endangered Species Act and concluded that the squirrel was not endangered or threatened. In doing so, the service explained why the by-then stale 1990 recovery plan criteria were outdated and did not control the delisting analysis. The plain language of the statute does not require anything more. First, starting with Section 3 of the statute, that's where the terms endangered species and threatened species are defined. And they're defined in terms of the danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of the species range. Threatened species is similar, the risk that's become an endangered species within the foreseeable future throughout all or a significant portion of its range. So those definitions are key to the Act. They frame what follows in Section 4A1. 4A1 then provides the five factors that guide the service in determining whether the species is in the category of an endangered species or out of the category of an endangered species. And those five factors we can talk about in a few minutes. I want to move quickly to Section 4B as well. That section then defines the type of data the service is to use in assessing whether the species remains endangered or threatened or is not.
All right, so then Congress adds this provision regarding recovery plans.
Right, Section 4F.
Right.
And so Section 4F requires recovery plans. It does not indicate that the recovery plan or their criteria, however, control delisting. It doesn't alter or amend the list of five factors in 4A1. Those five factors are comprehensive and thorough. They require the service to take a really good look at various threats.
So the service in 1985 says, the squirrel is endangered.
Right.
And then it reports to Congress on progress, et cetera. And then Congress amends the statute, and EPA comes up with this plan and lists the things that have to happen for it to conclude that this squirrel is recovered or its listing category should be changed, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Well, The 1990 is when the recovery plan was promulgated, and it includes tasks to improve the status of the squirrel, research study, protecting more habitat, a huge list of tasks. It includes these criteria as well, four criteria that set forth.
So then Congress says, well, you have to report to our committee every 2 years and let us know what's going on here.
Right.
And then it says, but if you're going to change this recovery plan, you have to give notice and comments. And I gather your point is, well, the agency discovered its original assumptions were incorrect, and therefore going through this notice and comment would be a useless gesture, and given the notice and comment it gave, that was sufficient. Is that correct?
It's close. It's not the whole picture.
All right. But I mean, you say basically you don't have to look at the recovery plan because the agency is treating this not as a regulatory directive or requirement, but just some guidance to the agency. And it's the four factors in A1 that are critical.
The five factors in A1 are critical.
All right.
The recovery plan and its criteria can't be ignored by the agency, but they don't control the analysis. So
why can't they be ignored? If they're relevant, I guess statutory theory then, because I thought your statutory theory was this is all controlled by the factors in A1, and really the recovery plan drops out when you're looking just at the factors in A1. So I'm having trouble fitting F into this.
The service's theory here is A1 controls, the five factors control. However, in 1990, the service explained what it thought at the time, based on its understanding of the squirrel, would be required to move the squirrel to a recovery status.
Right.
So it has this explanation. The recovery plan is very detailed. We fast forward.
Could it delist if it didn't do something that was specified in the recovery plan?
Yes, it can delist without doing something specified in the recovery plan. And maybe it could even delist without explaining that. That's not the case here, because the service did explain it.
Right.
And so the service...
Your theory is, yeah, it was explained here. I take your litigation theory here, but your theory is really the recovery plan is separate and apart from the delisting determination, right?
Our theory is it's separate apart from the delisting determination. The statute is clear. Delisting depends on the 5-4A1 factors, and those factors are comprehensive. Now, the service has recognized that when it does a recovery plan.
Here, your theory, let me just make sure I understand it, because I thought in the brief it articulated it different ways in different places. Here, you went beyond what the statute might require, as I understand your theory, because you did address the recovery plan. Even though I think you just said you don't have to address the recovery plan when you're doing a delisting.
I guess we weren't trying to take a position on that issue or not, because that's not the
facts. Well, now I know why I was confused reading your...
So what we're trying to say is, on the facts here, given what the service has done, we satisfy the 4A1 criteria, and to the extent that there is a duty, we've satisfied to look at the recovery plan criteria. We did that too. The service did that too.
Here's what I'm not clear about. In the final rule, you attached your analysis of the recovery plan criteria,
right,
which was an analysis dated after the notice of proposed rulemaking was issued.
Right.
So the first time anybody knew about the agency's analysis here was at the time of the final rule. So that if, hypothetically, in the plan it had stated that it would be inappropriate under the Endangered Species Act to delist this squirrel unless the agency were to find there were, hypothetically, 5 million of these squirrels in the mid-central part of the United States. Your position, as I understand it now, is you don't have to address that in any way, and you don't have to give notice as to why you no longer think that requirement must be met. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. The first premise of that this was not floated until the analysis is I think incorrect. There's two places where the service explained what it was going to do with respect to the recovery plan criteria.
Well, I'm looking at the notice of proposed rulemaking.
Right. Okay.
And I see exactly what the service told the public, and it did not tell the public, this analysis that is in this December 2007 document.
Backing up one step,
yep.
Before this notice, the 2006 five-year status review of the species described the recovery plan and its criteria and announced the Fish and Wildlife Service's interpretation of the statute that those criteria do not control. The proposed rule then, granted, did not list the criteria, but reiterated that same interpretation.
Could I just be clear, counsel?
Yep.
The 2006 analysis, where was that published?
That was published in the five-year status review for the squirrel, and it's
it's somewhere in the Federal Register.
The five-year status review. I think there's a notice of it, but the actual review itself is not included in the Federal Register.
Well, then how would I find out about it?
It's referenced in the proposed rulemaking. It explains that's out there.
And what do you mean? It was out there. I'm trying to find out where is it out there.
And it's. I believe the way it works is there was a notice that they were doing a five-year status review. There were comments submitted and responses to them, and then a notice that it was being released. The whole thing, I don't think, is released in the Federal Register.
I'm clear. I'm a squirrel lover.
Right.
And I'm happy it's listed. And how do I find out about the agency's change of plan?
Well, the proposed rule references the five-year status review.
All right, I find out about it December 19th, 2006, in the proposed rule that's published in the Register. Is that right?
That is when it was, yes.
All right, and where do I find a reference there to this analysis?
Well, there's two places. Starting on page Joint Appendix 173,
yep.
That's where we have a nearly page discussing the recovery plan.
I'm looking for this.
The reference to the,
thing you say that everybody had an opportunity to comment on.
I don't see the reference. I will look for it from in my reply time.
All right. I didn't see it
in any event
in your brief. So as I understood it from what was in this record, and I may be wrong, is that the agency publishes the notice of proposed rulemaking, and it lists in summary fashion its view. And then the first time I get to see the analysis is when the final rule comes out.
Yeah, I found the reference. Okay. Second column of page 174, end of the first paragraph.
Right.
Therefore, our analysis of the threats to this squirrel was based largely on the recently completed five-year review site. This review is available at website. So it's in there. If you look at that review,
okay,
then.
Okay, so I'm clear. This is this website. I have to monitor the website, right?
If you read the proposed rule, it mentions the website, and that's where the five-year status review is there. You don't have to monitor the website. If you read the Federal Register, it tells you it's there.
Okay, and where in this record am I going to find that?
The five-year status review, then, is in Joint Appendix, starts at Joint Appendix 289 in Volume 2.
Four, great.
In any event, we have the five-year status review, the proposed rule, and then the final rule. We think all clearly explain how the service is going to treat the recovery plan criteria, that it's not going to treat them as binding, and rather it's going to analyze the 4A15 factors to determine whether the species remains endangered or is no longer endangered.
Okay, so when the final rule comes out with this analysis, is that different than the five-year status review?
No, I don't think so. It follows the five-year status review, which recommended the same course the agency took here.
The bottom line is the same, but is the analysis the same?
I think the analysis is the same. It finds four reasons why the squirrel is no longer endangered, four broad reasons. One, the service has found more of them. Two, more locations. Three, the squirrel's habitat has improved. And four, the places where the squirrel has been located, the squirrel has persisted over time. Those are the four driving factors here that show the squirrel went from what it was believed in 85, incredibly rare and severely fragmented habitat, to the case at the time of delisting, more squirrels, more places, better habitat, and persisting across generations there, showing that that the squirrel is occupying that habitat and not simply passing through.
Okay, so when I went to the, before oral argument, to page JA-289, what I found was the recovery plan. Is that right?
Now, this is the five-year review, JA-289, the five-year review summary and evaluation, April 2006.
All right.
The recovery plan's in...
Well, it says here's the recovery plan. It starts at JA-291.
291, the five-year status review has a section that describes the recovery plan or outline. The following page, 292 to 293, is where it explains that the criteria were first developed over 15 years ago and need updating. And second, recovery criteria and actions are, for the most part, combined and generalized for both the West Virginia squirrel, that's what we're talking about here, and the Carolina squirrel. We're not talking about it. It was listed at the same time as the West Virginia squirrel. On the next page, then, it goes on and describes why the 1990 recovery plan does not have up-to-date recovery criteria. So that's the 2006 pre-proposed rule, reference in the proposed rule, description of the recovery plan criteria.
So in response to Judge Kavanaugh's question, your position is, under your interpretation of the statute, none of this is required?
I don't think we've sketched out. The Fish and Wildlife Service here did it, so we haven't taken a position on whether it's required or not. What is required is analysis of the delisting factors, and what I think the structure of the statute reveals is, especially with not non-stale recovery plan criteria, recovery plan criteria are supposed to be based on the five delisting factors. So if you
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
It would be an overlapping analysis. If the service here analyzed the criteria, an up-to-date modern criteria that were based on the five factors, and then analyze the five factors, it would be looking at the same data. Where are the squirrels? What are the threats to the habitat? Are there disease or predation risks? All those factors are supposed to now drive the creation of recovery plan criteria, and so you have the same analysis.
Most of the time, the analysis of the delisting factors will overlap, is your position, with the analysis of the recovery plan criteria.
Right.
And so they were all discussed. They were discussed adequately here, is your position?
Right. Most of the time, in more modern plans, there'd be even more overlap here. The recovery plan criteria are a little more generalized. In any event, the service addressed them.
So we don't need to address a case where, hypothetically, the service ignored the recovery plan criteria in delisting.
You don't need to address that case. That's definitely not the case here.
I think your argument would suggest that if you were to say in the delisting, because we've discovered new fact X, the recovery plan is irrelevant, we're not going to go through all the elements of it.
That's right. If they said that, then maybe they wouldn't have to. The question would then be, is fact X supported by the best available scientific and commercial data? That's the issue that's not, you know, hasn't been litigated yet,
so
in this case.
It was not obligatory for you to go through the recovery plan elements.
I don't think it's obligatory. But they did it here, and so we're just defending the record here. In any event, even the statement you said would be touching on the recovery. It wouldn't be completely ignoring it. It wouldn't be a rule that doesn't mention recovery plan criteria anywhere, but rather a rule that says, look, there are a lot more squirrels, stop. There's a lot more behind that, but that at least would be some explanation.
A hypothetical where the service just doesn't mention the recovery plan at all is something that this case doesn't present, right?
Right. That does not present it here at all. We have the status review, the five-year status review, the proposed rule referencing that, plus the final rule, all opining on the recovery plan criteria and why the squirrels recovered shouldn't be listed under the five factors, despite any tension with the recovery plan criteria from 1990.
I just want to be clear. What is this document then at JA 203?
203?
This is analysis of recovery plan criteria prepared December 18, 2007 by the West Virginia Field Office.
It is the further analysis of the recovery plan criteria that was referenced in the final rule and released. You know, it's dated before the final rule came out, but is referenced in the final rule as further justifying it's referenced on page 182, why the of Joint Appendix, why the recovery plan criteria need not be satisfied in full because of the status of the squirrel.
And just so I'm clear, your point is that by referencing the five-year review, notice was given of any of the relevant analysis vis-a-vis the criteria that had been identified in the recovery plan.
It's a combination of referencing it, and the proposed rule explains why the service doesn't believe the recovery plan criteria control its delisting analysis. So it's those two prongs is what puts this on notice. Now, it's clear here, if you look at JA 720 to 725, that plaintiffs knew this was on the table. Their first comment, and it spans those five pages, is you're not treating the recovery plan criteria correctly. And that's in response to the proposed rule. So this is not a case where there's any hiding the ball and plaintiffs were confused. They knew the issue and they opined at length about why they disagree with the service's interpretation. But there's no sign here of any sort of error because of this or any sort of confusion on the part of the plaintiffs.
So when I look at the document at JA 203, which is attached to the final rule, it is like a technical analysis modified in light of comments received?
Just to be clear, it wasn't attached. It was referenced. So I don't want to give the impression that it was actually attached to the Federal Register. I think that's right. It's a more technical analysis of the recovery plan criteria, expanding on what the final rule has said about it.
Well, my notes show I wrote attachment, a link to the final rule. I may be wrong, but that's what I thought it was.
It's referenced in the final rule, but it was not in the Federal Register.
But you could download it.
Excuse me?
You could download it.
It's...
Is that right?
This analysis, well, the five, I'm not sure at the status of the time if there was a, I don't think there was a website linked to it in the 2006 and 2008 final rule. But it is, plaintiffs were aware of it and was, I'm not sure exactly where it was downloadable at the time. And I don't know if the record reveals that. In any event.
So it was not part of the final rule?
Well, I think it's a technical explanation referenced in the final rule that that provides a greater detail to someone who wants to know exactly how the report.
So I read the final rule, and suppose hypothetically I disagree with the agency's conclusion. How would I get a hold of this revised analysis?
I'm, at the time, I don't know in August 2008 if it was available on the services website or not. There's no link to the website there.
I'm just thinking about my petition to the agency for reconsideration. I wouldn't have access to this. I'm just asking.
It's. I think they had access. They cited this in their lawsuit. It's, you know, it's, they had it. It's in the administrative record. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I just don't know the answer to how it was released at the time. Two final points. I mean, one, even if there's any ambiguity here about the plain language of the statute, we've set forth in our brief where it's interpreted, and we think the interpretation is clear, and this case then should be decided in the service's favor on Chevron step two. Second, about the inadequate regulatory mechanisms, that's the final issue in our brief. We think the word inadequate is key. That word means that unless there's some other threat to the species, there's no way to analyze the inadequacy of the regulatory mechanism. So I'm happy to answer questions of that.
Can you summarize succinctly what you think, again,
yep.
Plain language of the statute says?
For 4A1 or the factor D?
The recovery in a delisting, the plain language of the statute says that the recovery plan criteria are?
In a delisting, the plain language of the statute says the service should look at the section 4A1 five factors. Mm-hmm. That's what the plain language of the statute requires. And that's the end of it. Now,
and those will often overlap with the recovery plan criteria.
Right.
But not always, and to the extent they don't overlap or they're different, 4A1 controls. Is that your?
4A1 controls. Okay. There might be a case down the road where there's no comment on the recovery plan criteria at all. That would be different. Here there's explanation about it, and that satisfies any sort of obligation the service has with respect to the criteria.
So what about the fifth factor?
The inadequacy of regulatory mechanisms. Yeah. So that's...
Respondents referenced those two scientists who were hired who did not recommend delisting.
The peer review of the, well, that goes to their arbitrary and capricious claim that the delisting here was, or the treatment of the recovery plan criteria.
But you say the five factors control.
Yes.
All right, so what about the fifth factor?
And I think our argument to that is that's not what the district court held. We are happy to defend the record here and the treatment of those, all the factors, is non-arbitrary and capricious. The service explained in depth why the risks that plaintiffs cite are not present to the degree that justify listing under all of the factors in the analysis. The factor I was referencing is the one the district court said had to be separately analyzed, that's factor D, but I think your question goes to rather the more general arbitrary and capricious argument that has not been decided by the district court yet. The arbitrary and capricious argument they do make on appeal in their brief is not a ground the district court ruled on. This court usually remands. If the court does want to look at it, what it does show is the agency thoroughly explained, for all the reasons I've already stated, why that criterion about protecting four-fifths of the geographic recovery areas need not be satisfied, because that was based on the 1985-1990 understanding of the squirrel. Very few of them in very few places. All the evidence in the record shows there are more squirrels, more places, better habitat, and thus that criterion, based on a narrow understanding of where the squirrel was at the time, and it doesn't need to be satisfied in the same way. And we think that explanation satisfies the arbitrary and capricious standard.
So in the proposed rule, the agency says the recovery criteria do not specifically address the five threat factors used for listing, reclassifying, or delisting.
Right.
So is there overlap here or not?
Well, this case is not one where there's a lot of overlap. There's two district court cases from here in D.C., the Fund for Animals and Defenders of Wildlife.
No, I'm trying to understand this case. As you can tell, my questions have focused
right.
on
this case, there is not as there is some overlap, but it's not nearly as precise as that would be in a case with a later recovery plan and criteria that actually mention and address the five factors.
So the agency says thus, and there's data between. I'm on JA-174, in the second column, thus these focus areas for recovery which do not have formal or regulatory distinction are outdated. Therefore, our analysis to the threat was based largely on the recently completed five-year review that I can download.
Right. So there the service is explaining that the 1990 plan was based on a understanding and data on the squirrel that was limited. We've got much better data. The 2006 five-year status review goes through it in depth, and now we're going to delist based on this improved data, or proposing to delist at that point. And that sort of analysis is seems to me to make complete sense both with what the statute requires and also just in a sensible basis.
So when Congress amends the statute to say that the agency shall develop a recovery plan and implement the plan, it really didn't mean that?
No, it did, and the agency here did do that. What the Congress never says is that recovery plan and its criteria control the delisting analysis.
No, but it says if you're going to change the plan because new data, whatever,
right,
you have to give notice and comment that you're going to change it and how you're going to change it.
Right, and that makes sense as well. If you're going to revise the recovery plan, mm-hmm. for example, if midstream here there's a new threat to the squirrel or whatever species, and the recovery plan doesn't address that mm-hmm. new threat, it makes sense to put that revision out for notice and comment, get other perspectives on it, gather more scientific information, and then revise the recovery plan in light of that. But that the existence of that notice and comment process doesn't mean that the finish line for delisting set forth in 4A1 has been altered.
All right. So when the agency says we're seeking comments on these four propositions, under Congress's concept, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, you have to develop a plan, you have to implement it, and if you're going to change it, you have to give notice and comment. And presumably, if you're going to change it in the notice and comment, the agency would specify its reasons and whatever analysis it has. And you're saying, essentially, that was done here in this five-year review. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that...
No, I'm saying there was no revision of the recovery plan criteria here. Rather, the five-year review, it's a separate obligation under the statute.
So when Congress says you shall have a plan, you shall implement it, and if you're going to change it, you shall give notice and comment. The agency can just ignore the plan because it has this new data, as distinct from the agency giving notice that the plan has to be revised, and in fact our conclusion now is delist.
I think it...
Not true that, or is it, maybe I'm mistaken, is it true the plan has to be revised?
There's nothing that triggers and mandates revision of the plan.
But clearly, if the agency says we're listing the squirrel and here's our plan for recovery, all right, and say the recovery has 10 elements, and then you get some new data and you figure out, well, those 10 elements no longer, all of them no longer make any sense. I'm not clear why the agency wouldn't have to revise the plan.
Well,
in other words, the plan, if there were 10 elements and the agency says our new examination, the up-to-date scientific data shows that, you know, elements 1 through 6 are no longer relevant. And we think that as to the last four elements, those have been met. Therefore, the squirrel should be delisted. That's one process that gets you where you are now. But the agency is telling us you don't have to go through that process.
Well, the agency did exactly that here in a single process. It explained where the squirrel was in terms of recovery, all that data, then said we don't need to address the recovery plan criteria. And
I understand you want to argue that it's tantamount, but it's not the same.
No, it's not the same, but the statute gives the agency, there's two paths here the agency can take. It can do the after a five-year status review, if it determines that the 4A1 factors are not satisfied, that means it doesn't meet the species does not meet the definition of endangered or threatened. Once it makes that determination, then it delists the species. The other option is, okay, well, we have here some new data showing new threats, different threats, et cetera. We don't think it meets the delisting criteria. Now what are we gonna do with that data? One option to the agency is to revise the recovery plan, and that is set forth in the statute 4F. It notice and comment on that revision, new recovery plan, the agency moves forward from that point in an effort to continue to try to recover the species. But that final line is based on those 4A1 factors. If those are met, recovery has been achieved, the agency doesn't have then, it doesn't make sense then to say, we have a recovered species that doesn't meet the definition of endangered. Now what we're going to do is revise the recovery plan. It doesn't need to do that because it's found under 4A1, the species is out of the Act's protection.
Taking Section 4 as a whole, what Congress envisioned as the process, initially you look at the five factors and you decide to list or not list.
Right.
And you have to come up, if you decide to list, with a plan. And if you're going to revise the plan, you have to give notice and comment. But the agency's view is we can ignore the plan because it's just a guidance document, and we go back to 4A1, and that's all we have to do. And,
right.
And give notice that why our analysis now has changed of those five factors.
That's right. That's what we think the statute plainly sets up. 4A1 delisting, 4F recovery plan. The 4F does not control the 4A1. Delisting process. And here the agency went the extra mile of explaining why the recovery plan criteria were outdated, did not need to be followed, not all of them, but two of them, and why it could be delisted despite those 1990 recovery plan criteria.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for Appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court. The problem with the government's approach to delisting the squirrel is that it replaced the recovering delisting criteria for this species with less protective criteria without public notice and comment. Getting to the series of questions that Judge Rogers posed to government counsel, nowhere in the five-year review does the agency articulate the reasons that the recovery delisting criteria are no longer accurate measures of the squirrel's recovery, nor does it state that it's planning to meet them in intent. Specifically, looking to the five-year review, which is found at JA 292 and 293, which was referenced.
Can I ask a preliminary question? Why is the five-year review the relevant document as opposed to the notice in December 2006?
Your Honor, the proposed rule was what put the public on. This is fundamentally a public notice and comment case,
right.
And the proposed rule is the notice that was published in the Federal Register that put plaintiffs and other members of the public
on notice of delisting.
Which, that's right.
And delisting gives you notice that they're not only going to change a recovery plan but terminate the recovery plan, right? Just by the definition of delisting, not to mention the explanation here, when you delist something, needless to say, there's no longer going to be a recovery plan. So if you get notice of a proposed delisting, that's notice of a changed, in fact, a terminated recovery plan, no?
Your Honor, the recovery plan would no longer be valid once the species was removed from the protections of
right.
the Endangered Species Act.
So when you get notice of that, of the delisting, aren't you by definition getting notice of a changed terminated recovery plan? That's what I'm trying to get at the logic here.
The public was put on notice that the recovery plan for the squirrel would no longer be functional after it was removed from the protections of the ESA. But the
right.
proposed rule did not remove the squirrel from the protections of the ESA. The final rule removed the squirrel. And looking to the Endangered Species Act, Section 4F, it's clear from the statute that recovery plans, specifically the objective measurable recovery delisting criteria, which are in Section 4F1B2, they shall be implemented, is the language of the statute. And furthermore, when met, the agency shall implement criteria which, when met, would result in a determination in accordance with the provisions of this section, which all parties agree is the whole of Section 4, that the species be removed from the list. Congress intended that the objective measurable recovery delisting criteria in a species recovery plan were going to be operative at the moment that the determination was made. That's their entire purpose, is to determine when the species has recovered. And so while plaintiffs, there's nothing in the proposed rule or this five-year review that would put plaintiffs on notice of the on-the-ground criteria that the government planned to use in judging whether the species recovery had been met. It's important to understand.
Can I just be very clear about that? In the proposed rule, it says, it lists five things. It says recovery actions have resulted in a reduction in the threat that has led to significant increase, multiple generation, proven resiliency, vast improvement of suitable habitat. And then it says we want comments on this. And you can't just tell us you disagree. We want technical data on these five or four things. And then it gives you this website listing. And what is it that you don't have notice of? That's what I need to be clear about.
Your Honor, I think looking at the proposed rule, specifically the pieces of information that the agency was soliciting, give an indication of what people were put on notice of. The agency was asking for evidence of population. That goes specifically to one of the criteria in the squirrel's objective measurable recovery plan. In plaintiff's comments, they expressed uncertainty about whether the agency was jettisoning the objective measurable criteria altogether or whether they were replacing them with something. This is at JA 724 and 725. Specifically, plaintiffs asked whether, quote, is it the service's position that the populations should not be stabilized in at least 80% of the GRAs? This refers to the objective measurable recovery criteria for the squirrel in the squirrel's recovery plan that would require stable or expanding populations in 80% of these designated geographic areas. And this was important because in the recovery plan, the Fish and Wildlife Service stated that these stable or expanding populations would be measured biannually over a 10-year period.
Suppose you met criteria that were set forth in a recovery plan, but you didn't meet the 4A1 factors. You would say you couldn't delist then, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The 4A
4A1 factors control in that circumstance.
The two are hand-in-hand, as government counsel stressed. You
no,
can't
but not really hand-in-hand, because if the agency sets forth criteria in the recovery plan that are lower than what's necessary to delist under 4A1, you're going to say that's no good for delisting.
The objective measurable recovery delisting criteria are intended to be the on-the-ground
right.
measures of whether the 4A1 factors have been met.
They could not only set something below what's necessary under 4A1, they could also theoretically, and that's what I'm trying to get at, set forth criteria that are above what would be necessary for delisting under 4A1.
There's supposed to be a close nexus between the 4A1 factors and the objective measurable recovery criteria.
You're saying, I guess, that you can't delist under 4A1 if you haven't met the objective reasonable criteria that the agency itself set forth in the recovery plan, correct?
Yes, unless the agency changes the recovery plan through the notice and comment procedure.
The procedure to change the plan. Yeah. What's the purpose of doing that, to have two notices and comments followed back to back?
Well, Your Honor, the public must be put on notice. That's clear from the statute. We have not argued in this court that that must be two separate procedures.
But isn't that the logic of your position? In other words, you would do a notice and comment to change the recovery plan, and then having changed the recovery plan, you'd do a notice and comment on delisting.
No, Your Honor, that would not be necessary. And I think looking to what happened in this case, that would not be necessary because what the statute requires is public notice and an opportunity for public review and comment on the new revised recovery plan. That could be given in a proposed rule, but it was not in this case, Your Honor. Here,
it's more of a factual. So if they did a proposed delisting that said, and by the way, this proposed delisting is a proposed revision of the recovery plan in the sense that it's going to end the recovery plan, is that good or not good from your perspective under the statute? I'm going
to
repeat it.
To clarify, does Your Honor mean that the recovery plan would no longer be operative and nothing was replacing it?
Mm-hmm.
That would not be acceptable. There must be revised, the agency must have objective measurable delisting criteria under Section 4F. If the agency has developed those, they must apply them. And if the facts on the ground have changed that require revision to those objective measurable delisting recovery criteria, then the agency must use the notice and comment procedure that Congress requires.
And where did you find that in the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Section 4F, 4 and 5 of the Endangered Species Act, which is 16 U.S.C. 1533.
So just in my hypothetical about if the recovery plan had 10 elements and the agency gave notice that as a result of new data, et cetera, the first six elements were no longer relevant, and that the four remaining elements had been met, and that led the agency to determine that the squirrel should be listed. Is that consistent with 4F?
Yes, Your Honor, if the agency is being clear about the criteria by which it's judging the species recovery.
You say it wasn't clear, but as counsel pointed out to me that, you know, on the second page of the notice of proposed rulemaking, it gives this website of the five-year review. And then the five-year review talks about the recovery criteria. And in other words, isn't this the analysis that the agency is relying on?
No, Your Honor. The agency relies on the analysis that postdates the proposed rule. And
well,
it's instructed to compare the two.
All right. And so what is the difference?
The difference is here in the five-year review that Your Honor is referring to, and this is JA-292, mm-hmm. The agency said that the recovery plan was outdated because it was developed over 15 years ago, and that the recovery criteria and actions were combined and generalized for two subspecies of the flying squirrel, which were listed together. However, looking to the analysis that the agency fundamentally used to justify its position after public comment was closed on the proposed rule, this is JA-203, it's clear that the agency decided to jettison two of the four recovery criteria and instead substitute new criteria by which the squirrel's recovery was going to be measured. In lieu of these 80%, stable or expanding populations in 80% of these geographic areas, which was the objective measurable criteria in the recovery plan, which plaintiffs and other members of the public were relying on to measure the squirrel's recovery. Instead, the agency says that it's not measuring population anymore. There's nothing in the proposed rule that would put the plaintiffs on record of that. Specifically, the proposed rule solicits comments on the status of the squirrel's population. Instead, the analysis at 203 and 204 of the joint appendix states that the agency is defining persistence. This is at the top of JA-204, the second sentence. We define persistence as continuing captures of squirrel over multiple 3 to 5 generations at previously documented sites throughout the historic range. And the reference there is to another document, which is the document that the agency would use to measure the squirrel status once it's removed from the list. And that document defines persistence as being over a 5-year period by looking at nest boxes to see whether the squirrels are present. This was different fundamentally than the objective measurable recovery criteria, and the public was never put on notice that this was going to be the standard by which the squirrel would be recovered.
I still don't understand how the notice of the delisting doesn't work to put you on notice. Boy, we better marshal, and I think you did, marshal all our arguments for why it needs to continue to be listed as on the list, and the recovery plan and arguments you could make, or the recovery plan criteria haven't been met, the 4A1 factors haven't been met, which often overlap. You're going to put in everything you can come up with, right?
Your Honor,
because once it's delisted, recovery plans are out the window. Right? We agreed on that.
Once it's finally delisted, Your Honor, the plaintiff's comments make clear they don't know whether the stable or expanding populations is the standard by which the Fish and Wildlife Service is measuring the squirrel's recovery.
In other words, is it a question that, as you read the statute, Congress, by requiring there be a plan and it be implemented, and if any change is to be made, then the agency has to give notice, is the burden is on the agency to come up with the documentation to support the change, as distinct from in the delisting context, the way the notice of proposed rulemaking is stated, it's the burden of the people commenting to put in the data. In other words, you say you didn't know, or your clients didn't know exactly what the agency was relying on, but in that document, this 5-year review, the agency talks about new population information. And it talks about this in this section called Updated Information and Current Status of the Species. And what I was trying to understand in my questions with agency counsel was how this is does not the downloaded document provide notice of the agency's latest thinking? That is the scientific data on which it is relying in saying that it's now concluding that the squirrel should be delisted.
No, it does not, Your Honor.
And that's because you weren't clear as to what standard the agency was going to use?
That's because it wasn't clear to the public the criteria by which the squirrel's recovery was going to be measured. And I think it would be illustrative to give a couple examples. For example, the analysis that postdated the proposed rule on which the agency relied in its final rule in delisting the squirrel looks at squirrel's presence over a 5-year period. On the other hand, the objective measurable recovery criteria in the squirrel's recovery plan talks about a 10-year period. That's at JA-273. The public and peer reviewers should have had an opportunity to comment on whether 5 years was an adequate period to judge whether presence is evidence of recovery. Another example is that persistence, as the agency defines it, is a certain number of captures of squirrels over this 5-year period. However, looking to JA-458, this is an early version of the 5-year review in which the agency was still considering keeping the species listed. Figure 4, this is at the bottom of 458, shows how the squirrel was faring at 10 long-term monitoring sites. And it shows that the capture rate for squirrels at these 10 long-term monitoring sites was declining. By the agency's new standard of persistence, continued captures of the squirrel would be sufficient to demonstrate recovery, whereas the squirrel could be persisting at a very low rate, or the population could be actively declining, or at least the number of captures at these long-term monitoring sites might be declining, so long as there were some squirrels being captured in these five-year periods by these new standards. This would satisfy the agency's new criteria that it substituted for the objective measurable recovery criteria. And it's important, it wasn't only the public who didn't have an opportunity to comment on this new approach, it was also the peer reviewers. There were two peer reviewers who were held out by the service as being independent academics. Dr. Weigel, who was instrumental in early research on the squirrel and who was referred to in the listing rule and served on the recovery plan, and Dr. Pagels, who also had done a lot of important work on the squirrel, including capturing the squirrel in Virginia. He was one of the only scientists who'd been able to capture the species in the Virginia part of its range. And both of those peer reviewers expressed concerns about the service's decision to delist. They may have been able to bring information to bear on the new standards that this agency was using to delist the squirrel, but they weren't given that opportunity, nor was the public, in violation of Section 4F.
So your statutory theory, let me just make sure I have it straight. So the delisting, when the agency puts forth a recovery plan with objective, measurable criteria, the agency can't just delist without meeting those criteria that are set forth in the recovery plan. If it wants to delist, it first has to change the criteria that are listed in the recovery plan in a new recovery plan, and then show that it's met those new criteria?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the...
In other words, if it hasn't met the old criteria that are in the original recovery plan, so the agency says, we haven't met the criteria in the original recovery plan, we're going to change the recovery plan and delist. It's going to go through a two-step process, right? New recovery plan with new criteria, and then say, oh, we've met the new criteria, therefore delist.
Right? No, Your Honor, that would be ideal, but the Endangered Species Act requires simply that the public have notice and an opportunity to comment on the new criteria. That could be combined with the delisting rule, so long as it's in the proposed delisting rule, the rule that's open for public comment.
You're not saying what I'm taking your position one step further than you're taking it.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
So if the notice of proposed rulemaking had said, we think a five-year period is sufficient and the persistence standard rather than raw population numbers is adequate under the first five factors, that would have been that's the type of notice that you say would have been adequate.
Yes, Your Honor. If the agency enumerates new criteria and provides an explanation for why the agency is adopting those new criteria, the public has notice and an opportunity to comment, that's consistent with Section 4F of the Endangered Species Act and the Administrative Procedure Act. However, here, the agency specifically solicited information on populations of the squirrels, but then didn't measure its recovery based on populations.
Do you have a legal disagreement with the agency, or just a factual disagreement about what was in the notice?
Yes, Your Honor, we have a legal disagreement. We believe that objective measurable recovery criteria in this species recovery plan are binding on the agency when it makes a determination that the species be removed.
You don't think they're binding as long as they put it in the notice that they're changing, that they don't think those criteria are relevant anymore.
The agency is free to change what the criteria are using the procedures and sections.
So they're not binding.
Whatever the objective measurable criteria the agency has adopted are binding on the agency. Here, the agency either needs to change them via notice and comment or abide by them, and it has done neither.
The change, sorry to beat this, I just want to make sure I understand it. The change can be in the same notice as the notice of delisting.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you get this out of 4F4.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, 4F4 talks about so says the Secretary shall, prior to final approval of a new or revised recovery plan, provide public notice, opportunity for comment. Doesn't say anything about terminating the recovery plan or simply abandoning it, as it were. So I take it you're not making a Chevron Section 1 argument here, but a Section 2 argument.
Your Honor, under Chevron Step 1, the
Such step one, pardon me, yes.
Endangered Species Act is clear that the agency shall develop and implement plans.
Doesn't say that. It says shall, prior to final approval, provide public notice and opportunity for comment. That's what you're telling me is your authority here, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so it doesn't address what happens when it wants to abandon the plan or simply terminate the listing. In other words, it doesn't seem to be addressed specifically in this provision.
Your Honor, that is addressed specifically in Section 4F1B2, which requires the implementation of objective measurable criteria.
And you'd also say, I thought, that a terminated plan is, by definition, revising the plan. That's a helpful question. Right? I thought under four, when you say a new or revised recovery plan, are you not saying, I thought you were, that when you terminate the recovery plan, by definition, you're revising it, and thus you must have notice and comment before you do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Okay.
Where do you find that?
I believe Section 4F, when read as a whole, the 4F1B2 requires...
Congress specifically addressed this, is what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
But only if one looks at the whole situation, not any particular wording.
Yes, Your Honor. This court frequently...
So the Secretary looks at the whole situation and comes up with a different view, but we're not even to consider whether that's reasonable because the Congress has actually addressed this question.
Our reading is the only reading of the statute that gives full effect to all of its provisions. Congress specifically amended the Endangered Species Act to require recovery plans, and then again amended it to require objective measurable criteria by which to measure the species recovery.
And still didn't say anything about what to do on terminating it. I mean, to revise the plan with respect to a species that the agency is no longer, says according to the statutory criteria, the five in the statute, is no longer endangered, does seem to be a little bit counterintuitive. One would want to know that the Congress actually said that.
Your Honor, it's allowing the public notice.
Are you not making a step two argument also?
We are also making a step two argument, Your Honor.
Now, if I understand your brief correctly, you're making that the step one and step two argument and an arbitrary and capricious argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which you've recast a little bit here today in terms of the inadequacy of notice.
Your Honor, I believe that fundamentally that's what our briefs talk about, inadequacy of notice.
So what your discussion here about the inadequacy of notice is meant to elaborate the arbitrary and capricious argument, not the statutory interpretation.
Your Honor, we believe it goes to both arguments. The statute here requires notice and comment, as we've been discussing. But even under normal APA principles, what the agency did here is unlawful. The agency introduced new criteria by which the recovery would be measured after the closure of public comment. That violates the basic APA principle that a final rule should be the logical outgrowth of a proposed rule. And plaintiffs clearly raised concerns about didn't know what the agency was doing, how the agency was measuring recovery, and again, I would refer the court to JA 724, in which the plaintiffs asked specifically, is the service's position not that you should follow this recovery plan, recovery criteria for stable populations in 80% of GRAs? We can only guess. And then they specifically asked,
did you go into the logical outgrowth cases?
We cite the logical outgrowth cases in our brief, Your Honor.
All right.
I can find that citation for you. Perhaps I can refer the court after government.
If you say they're there, we'll find them.
I see my time is up if there are no further questions.
Let me ask you one other thing, if I may. We haven't talked about G at all. In other words, As you're reading subsection F, subpart 4, Well, what I'm trying to get at is F1 starts out by saying the secretary shall develop and implement plans unless he finds such a plan will not promote the conservation of the species. Suggesting perhaps implicitly a reference back to the A1 factors.
Yes, Your Honor. The Section 4F directly references the A1 factors in 4.1b.2, in which it talks about determinations in accordance with the provisions of this section that the species be removed from the list.
Right. But what I'm getting at is that it was jogged by Judge Kavanaugh's question about you could have a plan that requires more than the five factors in 4A, for whatever reason. I mean, that was his hypothetical. So then G says that, do you think G applies to the squirrel in this case? Species which have recovered to the point where measures are no longer necessary?
Is the court asking whether we believe continued monitoring is necessary for the squirrel after it's delisted?
Well, I'm trying to understand what Congress had in mind, and as you can tell from questions, if the secretary decided he didn't need a recovery plan any longer because, let's just hypothetically say, it's undisputed these squirrels are running everywhere and there's just not a problem anymore. But G says, well, the secretary still has to monitor this. So that's sort of an added protection, if you understand what I mean. It doesn't have the same protection as a listing.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case,
I don't want to take everybody's time with that.
If I may, Ms. Elmy, I have it on good authority that the phrase logical outgrowth doesn't appear in your brief. So if after we've heard the government in reply, you can simply give me a case citation in the brief, I would appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Second, is it correct, as the government maintains and as I think from my reading of the case is correct, that your position would require us to split from the Fund for Animals case in the 11th Circuit in terms of statutory interpretation?
Your Honor, the Fund for Animals case
basically says that the recovery plans is guidance. It's not promulgated. It doesn't have the force of law. It's not promulgated as such.
It's important to look at the context of which that case was decided. This is Fund v. Rice, 85F3535. That was a challenge to a biological opinion under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, mm-hmm. based on a habitat protection plan that was found in the Species Recovery Plan. It's fundamentally different to be talking about Section 4, how Section 4F functions in determinations under Section 4 about the determination of status for a species, as opposed to Section 7. Section 7 is fundamentally about what actions can be taken by agencies that would take endangered species without violating the take prohibition in the Endangered Species Act. And Section 7 requires a balancing of agency resources. So there, what the courts found there was that let me quote the court. This is at 547 of that opinion. The court states there would be absolutely no point to the consultation and preparation of a biological opinion, which is the operative document under Section 7, if the Fish and Wildlife Service's opinion were predetermined based on whether proposed project lands fell within the borders of properties discussed in any one of a number of recovery plan documents. There, the 11th Circuit, I believe, was fundamentally concerned with reading the statute as a whole and making sure that no provision, not one provision of the statute, didn't eviscerate another provision of the statute. In this case, that Section 4 didn't override Section 7. We have no similar conflict here. In fact, here, the position that is urged by the conservation organizations is to read the Section 4 holistically and give meaning to every part of Section 4.
So when they said the practical effect of the plaintiff's position would be to elevate the recovery plan into a document with the force of law, 4F, that's 51533F, 4F makes it plain that recovery plans are for guidance purposes only, they were speaking a little too broadly?
Well, Your Honor, that may be dicta in the court's opinion. However, we are not asking this court to determine whether everything in a recovery plan is binding on the agency in all circumstances. What we are asking this court to decide is whether section, or what the lower court opinion decided, was that section 4FB2 of the Endangered Species Act, which requires the implementation of objective measurable criteria, that those criteria will be implemented in making, quote, determinations. That the species be removed from the protections of the Endangered Species Act. It's a very narrow reading of the recovery planning provision, and it's entirely consistent with the 11th Circuit's decision in Fund.
On the recovery Fund plan for, sorry, F4, maybe this goes to the heart of the case, but shall, prior to final approval of a new or revised recovery plan, if we conclude that a terminated plan is not a new or revised plan, then you lose, correct?
I understand, Your Honor. When I was making my argument previously, I was responding to the court's questions with the understanding that what you meant by terminating a plan was substituting new criteria for old criteria, like the agency did here. I believe if the agency wanted to terminate a plan, if it is allowed by Section 4F at all, it would have to be a finding, as Judge Rogers was referring to, that the plan would not promote the conservation of the species. I believe that would be a different set of circumstances that would require that specific finding.
If it's clear, really undisputed in another case, that the requirements of the recovery plan have been met, and the agency terminates the listing, does it also have to terminate the recovery plan, or does that just lapse?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that recovery plans are intended to guide and then measure when recovery has been met. When a species is recovered under the Endangered Species mm-hmm. Act, mm-hmm. by definition, a recovery plan would no longer apply.
Because there's no endangered species to recover.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It lapses then. To answer
it would
your
seem
question,
to be,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no formal, right. We hereby right. delist so, and hereby terminate the recovery plan. That just.
Right. So it makes sense then, it may be wrong, but it's coherent for the government to say, well, when you've terminated the species, the recovery plan's neither here nor there.
Terminate the listing.
I'm sorry, terminated the listing. Well, it would be true either way, yes. With any luck, though, it's just the listing.
I think that argument highlights what's wrong with the approach that the government took here. Here, the government didn't invite the public to provide comment on replacing the recovery delisting criteria with less rigorous criteria. The first notice that the public had was in the final rule, at which time the squirrel was already delisted, and that's too late. That's a different set of circumstances than when the species has been recovered and necessarily the recovery plan no longer applies.
It is different.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Starting off with the termination or lapsing, I think lapsing may be the best way to look at this. The 4F4 applies to endangered or threatened species. If the species is removed from that category, then those obligations don't apply anymore and the duties then are lapsed or just not triggered. As to the process notice question, the proposed rule right at the outset, 173, right at the beginning, summarizes why it thinks delisting is on the table. One, a significant increase in the squirrels. This is in the second paragraph end of the first paragraph of the proposed rule. Two, increase in the number of capture sites. Two, increase in the number of squirrels. Three, multiple generation reproduction. Four, proven resiliency. And five, vast improvement and continued expansion of suitable habitat. That put plaintiffs on notice broadly, and there's been a lot more detail about all this, about what the service was going to base its decision on.
Ms. Almy's point, I think, was that some of the criteria that were being used were not identified. Sure, increased, but measured by what or increased? I think that was her point in response to that.
And then if you,
can you respond
in
to that?
The rule, it explains, here's how we're measuring the increase. It's not based on population data, but rather, and this is on page 175, the second full paragraph, there have been 1,141 captures. It goes through the sites. It goes through the distribution. It goes through the habitat. If you read the whole proposed rule, it's clear what the service is thinking about here and what it's considering.
I think you said an increased number of squirrels.
Right.
I thought you'd backed off of that position.
Well, there's
no... I don't know if there's an increased number, really.
And 175 doesn't explain that.
Well, 175 says there's an increased number of captures, and the right. outset here
more captures, more territory. Whether more squirrels seems to be very difficult to determine.
There's no calculation of population. I think at the end of the day, the service thinks there are more captures and more squirrels than at least it believed in 1985 and 1990, and when the exact timing of that growth occurred, and versus when there was just problems capturing them is not particularly clear.
Or whether I think they're just simply spread out over a larger territory. It's another possibility, right?
Right. I mean, right.
Could be the same or even a diminished population, but spread out more thinly, perhaps because what they feed on is less plentiful.
The population could be more dispersed. There's a certain, the record reveals how many squirrels can live in a certain area and how dense they think that is, at least the science seems to indicate. In any event, what the rule sets forth is the change in the understanding from 1985 and 1990 until 2006, and then the final rule. The second point...
Does it refer to a five-year period and persistence rather than population numbers?
It does not describe exactly how persistence, the period of time for persistence. Plaintiffs cite a 10-year period. I think that is based on the monitoring plan, which is at JA 230, and is required by Section 4G that Judge Rogers was asking about. That is the Section 4G says that plan has to be 5 years long. The service here has decided to do a 10-year plan instead, and so that's the 10-year time frame that is being used to assess how the squirrel is doing post delisting. So the squirrel's not being, it's been delisted, but it's the monitoring plan will still apply for 10 years following the effective date of the delisting. It doesn't make any sense to have new criteria here for the reasons we've already talked about. The criteria, once the service has determined that the squirrel doesn't meet the 4A1 criteria, it doesn't make sense then to have more recovery criteria or revised recovery criteria. The squirrel's either protected as endangered as defined by the act or not. If it's not, we don't need new revised recovery plan criteria. And finally,
it's such a circular argument. You say if it's recovered, you don't need a plan. The plan is to assure recovery.
Right. Well, the plan is not to assure recovery, but it's to move the squirrel towards recovery. But the statute, we think, is clear, and if it's not clear, that services interpretation should be accorded deference, that look at these five factors, and they're not narrow, they're really all encompassing, and decide whether the squirrel remains protected or not. And we think that interpretation best meets the goal of the Endangered Species Act, and to allow the agency here to remove species that no longer qualify as protected under the act, increasing the act's legitimacy and hopefully then allowing the agency to focus its resource on other species that do meet those 4A1 factors.
And what about the peer review comment?
Well, the peer review comment, it was submitted. It supports plaintiffs. It's relevant to plaintiffs' arbitrary and capricious argument. But it doesn't...
opportunity to comment on these new standards.
The peer review comments, the Dr. Weigel comment in particular, it focuses on, it simply doesn't address this issue one way or another. It focuses on the science behind the squirrel. He's a biologist, and his focus was on, in his comments that are in the joint appendix, was on whether the service is properly interpreting the squirrel's, the data supporting the squirrel or not, rather than the kind of process issue. And I wouldn't expect the biologists to focus on the process, but rather focus on the biology. And that's what his comments focus on. And that's the arbitrary and capricious argument not here right now. Unless the court has anything further?
Any further questions?
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advice.
Oh, yes. We have a logical outgrowth citation.
Oh, a citation.
If I may.
Yes.
If the court looks to the 27-page analysis that the government provided after the comment period was closed, in combination with the cases that we cite on page 38 of our brief and the footnote 10 on page 40 of our brief, and I would direct the court's attention in particular to COVAD Communications Company versus FCC 450 F3rd 528, and I believe at page 548 it directly addresses the logical outgrowth principle.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.